adjustments to order. And the first order of business is going to be a refresher training for the Board of Adjustments. The board meets fairly infrequently, and as a result, it's probably effective if we have a little time that we can review again our obligations under the law, and then we will proceed with the particular item of Mr. Derringer's application.
Hello. I'm just going to go through the documents you have in your packet. The first one is Board of Adjustment statute. Basically, we're just going to go through what the state law requires of the Board of Adjustment, and then what the city ordinances require.
A little louder, please.
Each municipal, starting with number one, this is 10-9A-701. Each municipality adopting a land use ordinance shall by ordinance establish one or more appeal authorities to hear and decide requests for variances from the terms of the land use ordinance, appeals from decisions applying the land use ordinance, and appeals from a fee charge in accordance with section 109A510. That section deals with fees that involve the review and approval of commercial or residential building plans, hookup fees for utilities, land use applications. So if somebody had an issue with those fees, that could come before the board also. Item number two there, as a condition precedent to judicial review, each adversely affected person shall timely and specifically challenge the land use authority's decision in accordance with local ordinance. And we'll get to our ordinance section on that. It's 9-1C-3A1, which basically states 45 days. Number three, the appeal authority shall act as a quasi-judicial manner, which basically means judicial in character. You have the right to hold a hearing and you have and conduct investigations. You serve as a final arbiter of issues involving the interpretation or application of land use ordinances and may not entertain an appeal of a matter in which the appeal authority or any participating member had first acted as the land use authority. So that would be in the case if one of you served on a land use authority on the Planning Commission, if they were making a decision or council or something, then you couldn't be a designated against. So by law, the municipality has designated you as an appeal authority. Down to number five, the municipality establishes, if the municipality establishes or prior to the effective date of this charter has established a multi-person board, body, or panel to act as an appeal authority, at a minimum, the board, body, or panel shall notify the members of any meetings or hearings that you'll be having. You provide each member with the same information and access to resources. You convene only if you have a quorum, and you act only upon the vote of a majority of the convened members. So this is a five-member board. We have four here today. Three of you constitutes a quorum, and three of you has to vote either way in an action. Has to be three, at least three of you. So next, let's talk about some variances. This is one of the items that the board addresses more often than anything else. Down about half the page, when it talks about a variance, the variance has to be associated with the property. The circumstances have to be peculiar to the property. So maybe the property has a power easement, a gully of some kind. Those things are normally caught when the development process is taken care of, but sometimes something may get missed. And if somebody's trying to use their land and they aren't being able to do that the way their neighbors can, then you go through the variance process. The appeal authority may not find an unreasonable hardship if the hardship is self-imposed or economic. And that's basically saying if somebody has a specific lot size and the zone requires certain setbacks, and they're trying to build a house that won't fit inside those setbacks just because they're trying to build a larger house, that would be a self-imposed hardship and not something that runs the full land. The appeal authority can find special circumstances that exist that relate to the hardship. It deprives the property of privileges granted to other properties in the same zone. But the applicant bears the burden of proving that there's an issue. They have to prove to you that they have a problem when they request a variance. A variance runs with the land. The appeal authority cannot grant a use variance. And a use variance would be something that relates to like a business, just because they're trying to run a business, that would be a use, or something like animal rights. You can't give them a variance to have like a horse if the zone doesn't allow for horses. Something like that would be a use variance. In granting a variance, the appeal authority may impose additional requirements in order to mitigate harmful effects. We're right there at the bottom of the page. The next page, page 3, 10-9A-703, the applicant, a board or officer of the municipality, or any person adversely affected by the land use authority's decision administering or interpreting a land use ordinance may, within the time period provided by ordinance, appeal that decision to the appeal authority by alleging that there is error in any order, requirement, decision, or determination made by the land use authority in the administration or interpretation of the land use ordinance. When somebody wants to meet with the Board of Adjustment, there's an application that they fill out, and they get that from me, the city recorder. And I explain to them, I go through their application, things that they should provide, and then it's their choice. The city cannot deny someone making application to the board. So it's their choice once they're given the information. It does talk a little bit about if there's geologic hazards, then the city can actually pull together a panel of qualified people to assist with the decision if there's something dealing with that type of issue. When they do that, the panel has an expert that the municipality picks, an expert that the applicant picks, and then they choose another person jointly. And none of those people can be related to or have an association with the applicant. The applicant then has to pay half the cost to provide the panel and the publishing fee that the municipality deals with. The next section, time to appeal. The city has enacted an ordinance stating when someone has time to appeal a decision, it's 45 days. The burden of proof. The appellant has the burden of proving that the land use authority erred. Due process. Each appeal authority shall conduct each appeal and variance request as provided in local ordinance. And we'll get to those in just a minute. Over on page 4, each appeal authority shall respect the due process rights of each of the participants. And so that's what we're following. Standard of review for appeals. Basically, when the Board of Adjustment meets, you meet on what's called de novo, where you begin anew. If you have to readdress something for any reason, you start anew each time. The appeal authority shall determine the correctness of a decision of a land use authority in its interpretation and application of a land use ordinance. Only those decisions in which the land use authority has applied to land use ordinance to a particular application, person, or parcel may be appealed to an appeal authority. So basically, if the land use authority has made a decision then that person can make application, but it has to have something that deals with land use. It can't be the color of someone's house. So if a house is being built by someone and it needs, you know, the building envelope and those kind of things, but the neighbor has an issue with the shingles being green or something, that's not something that would be brought before the board. Final decisions. A decision of an appeal authority takes effect on the date when the appeal authority issues a written decision or as otherwise provided by ordinance. A written decision or other event as provided by ordinance constitutes a final decision in state section 1098-801-2A. Basically, the city has a recording. The recording, according to the Open and Public Meetings Act, is kept for 1 year. And then there's the written minutes that are developed. Those are sent to the board. You guys can make any corrections, and then you talk with Priscilla, who's the chair, and she would approve the minutes. And the minutes, the written minutes, become the official record of the board's adjustment. And so your decision, once you make a decision tonight on any item, when you address an issue, when you make the decision, that's when the decision is final, unless you extend it for some reason to another date. 1098-801, no person may challenge in district court a municipality's land use decision made under this chapter or under a regulation made under authority of this chapter and until that person has exhausted the person's administrative remedies of providing a part of an appeal authority grant. Basically that same, they have to come see you first before they can take it to court. And your decision, the only other direction they have is to go to court. They can't take something, your decision cannot be taken to the city council or planning commission or anybody else. They go to court. And that's a 30-day restriction. Page 5 basically talks about what the court's going to do. The court will basically collect the records that were presented here. They're not going to collect any additional outside records. They will review exactly what you were presented here at your meeting, and that's what they will address. Items they could look at: minutes, findings, orders, the minute transcripts, the audio, any of those types of things. If there is no record, they could call witnesses and take evidence, but we always have a record with us. Page 6, we're going to start with the ordinances of the city. Basically, the Board of Adjustment, and what happened with state law a few years ago was state law carried the term Board of Adjustment, and then it decided to call it an appeal authority. But as a city, already had an established appeal authority, which we called the Board of Adjustment. We didn't have to go through and change everything. We were able to just leave the title as Board of Adjustment, but in state law they call it appeal authority, but it's the same. So with our Board of Adjustment in the city, you're a 5-member board. You have one ex officio officer, which is basically an appointed council member. Your term is for 5 years. You can be reappointed, which I know two of you for sure have, because you've been on the board for a long time. Or new members can be appointed. You have to live within the city. The mayor can actually remove a board member for cause if written charges are made. Otherwise, you're a set board. The organization of the meeting, of course, you have a chairperson, which is Priscilla. You meet at the call of the chair. And basically what we do with that is if I receive an application, I notify Priscilla. We discuss date options. Then I email all of you to try and determine what date works best for everybody. Then that goes back to Priscilla, and she picks the date. And then again, we start, making the packets and the agenda for the meeting. We do follow the open and public meeting laws. The Board of Adjustment files all of their records with the city recorder. All of your records are public records. As we mentioned, you have to have three concurring votes on an item. And we talked about decisions when they're effective. They're effective when they're at the end of the meeting or if you designate a separate time. The ordinance does talk about compensation, but unfortunately you're not compensated. The next section, we're on page 8, talks about powers and duties. The Board of Adjustment has the following powers and duties. So, to hear and decide appeals from zoning decisions applying to the zoning ordinance, subject, to a whole list right there. The applicant or any other person or entity adversely affected by a decision administering or interpreting a zoning ordinance may appeal that decision applying the zoning ordinance by alleging that there is error in any order, requirement, decision, or determination made by an official in the administration or interpretation of the zoning ordinance. The appeal is required in 45 days. Down on number 4, the person or entity making the appeal has the burden of proving that an error has been made. On number 5, decisions applying to the zoning ordinance, only decisions applying to the zoning ordinance may be appealed to the Board of Adjustment. Person may not appeal, and the Board of Adjustment may not consider any zoning ordinance amendments, which means you just can't change the current code. You're just making an interpretation. Appeals cannot be used to waive or modify the terms or requirements of the zoning ordinance. There could be special exceptions if the council asks you to address something. You're asked to deal with variances. Next, page number 9. Basically talks about variances. They have to prove a hardship. It can't be, has to be some kind of special circumstance that's attached to the property that is causing them to not have the same enjoyment of the property right that maybe their neighbor has. A variance cannot substantially affect the general plan, and it cannot be contrary to the public interest. And basically, the spirit of the zoning ordinance is observed and substantial justice done. The Board of Adjustment may not find an unreasonable hardship unless the alleged hardship is located on or associated with the property. If it's peculiar to the property, it can't be self-imposed. That's like we talked about. They're just trying to build a bigger house and what fits in the building envelope, that would be self-imposed. You can address special circumstances. And again, the applicant bears the burden of proving that they need a variance. A variance actually runs with the land, so if someone's owner's change of the house or on the property, it runs with the land. You cannot grant a use variance. We talked about that in state law, like a business or something. In granting a variance, the board can impose additional requirements in order to mitigate harmful effects. On page 10, the appeals from the board decision. This is basically the section that talks about if someone is dissatisfied with the decision of the board, then they have to take it to court. On page 11, provisions of state code. Any provisions of Utah Code annotated section 10.9700. Now this is in the city's ordinance code. 10.9700 has actually been amended, so it's actually 10.98701 through 708. And this section basically says if something in state law changes, then you are still required to abide by the law. The last section there, boundaries of zones, basically talks about if you're looking at the zone map and it was difficult to determine where the zone line falls, it basically talks about you go by streets and outlines, then you'll go to lot lines and those types of things in order to make your determination. And the last page where there it says where other uncertainty exists, the Board of Adjustment shall interpret the map. So if there's something right on the border of two zones and you're having a difficult time determining what zone it's in, then that's your interpretation to make. The last two pages there is just the variance worksheet that we have. It's basically six questions that the board goes through when you're looking at a variance. It specifically states what the answer to the question needs to be. And as you go through that application, if for that worksheet, if one question can't be answered correctly, then the board should not be giving a variance and they're addressing those. So that's basically Board of Adjustment in a nutshell. I did bring today some books, and some of you may have these. These are from the Utah League of Cities and Towns. Do all of you have that? Jeff got it? You got it. Do you have it, Priscilla?
I may.
Okay. Do you want
one? Not sure.
I can give you one. It basically goes through what we have just gone through as far as state law on the requirements of the control authority. So I can give you one of those. Did anyone have any questions?
Any changes in the last little bit that you're aware of on anything we normally do? Kim? I haven't heard of anything either. So. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much. All right. The main purpose of our meeting is to address Mr. Derringer's application for the Board of Adjustment for Enforcement of the Zoning Regulation and Interpretation of the Zoning Ordinance Text regarding the Community Recreation Center. Mr. Derringer.
Good evening. My name is Craig Carlisle. I'm a lawyer with Rakeley & Nebaker. I'm here representing Mr. Derringer. So I'll be making that presentation on his behalf.
Thank you.
I filed with the city and with the chair earlier today our responsive memorandum to what the city had filed 2 days ago. I have the original here for the record and then copies for others who may not have it. Actually, I have an additional copy for you because it's got the covered zoning map.
Thank you.
You also have that on
Okay.
the
Thank
floor.
You. I would like that, though.
We appreciate the opportunity to be here. This is obviously the appeal we filed on the issuance of the building permit for the Community Event and Recreation Center that we filed on June 30th of, the, of this month, or I'm sorry, of this year. The basis for that appeal was that the TR1 zone in which the facility is being constructed does not permit a recreational facility. And therefore, it's our position that the zoning administrator, the chief building inspector acting as the, the chief building official acting as the zoning administrator was in error in issuing that building permit because, again, it was not a permitted use in that zone. This procedurally, this is a fairly unique setting that we're in today because, as just explained, at least to some degree, you're sitting here as a quasi-judicial body making essentially a judicial decision based on evidence that will be presented here and assisting us in creating a record that the courts can look to and with some reliance if the matter is appealed by either party after this decision. It's one of the reasons why the Utah Code, as we've cited in the memorandum we just handed you, is adamant, I would say, in making sure that the due process rights of the participants are protected. That's also reiterated, I believe, in Cedar Hills ordinance that those rights ought to be protected. The Utah Supreme Court has indicated that the essence of due process is that somebody has an adequate opportunity to be heard in a meaningful manner. And that requires that there be adequate notice and opportunity to put together the evidence necessary to properly address the appeal. We have indicated in our memorandum there, and we had asked previously for an extension of time because we received the city's memorandum in this appeal 2 days ago. At the same time, we essentially received a notice from the board here that we're going to have this hearing this evening. It's our belief and position that that's an inadequate amount of time to be able to address the issues, and we just learned of the issues that were going to be presented by the city at that time. We've done our best to try to address those, and we'll proceed, but it continues to be our position that those due process rights have been compromised. We also, though not addressed in the memorandum, have concerns in the sense that the board has the duty to be impartial to both participants, the city and to Mr. Derringer, and that's virtually impossible to do when the lawyer who is representing the city is also the lawyer who apparently has been advising the board. So that is an additional concern. In the past experiences we've had in similar circumstances, the board ought to have counsel that's independent from the counsel who is advising the city as a participant in the appeal. Procedurally, those are the issues we have with what's where we're at to this point.
Carlisle, may I interrupt for one moment? While Ms. Kite does represent the law firm which represents the city, we have not had any personal interaction, any board members, with Ms. Kite in any relationship to this particular issue. So it needs to be stated clearly that there is no conflict at this time because we have not had any discussion about this.
I appreciate that explanation. I disagree with the conclusion. I think if they're your attorney in any regard, that creates an air of credibility for them that we might not otherwise enjoy because of your participation in different arenas, particularly in the zoning context. We are aware that they were aware of this meeting before we were, so there were some communications there that weren't being communicated to us at the same time, which would also indicate an indication that there's not the impartiality that's required.
So unless I'm not aware of something, I don't know that she represents us as a Board of Adjustments. I don't know that we requested her help. I don't know that I've had any communication with her. So to say that she represents the city is true, but to say that she represents the Board of Adjustment, as far as I know, is false.
So I appreciate the explanation. We do have the concerns, and you just have to note those in your deliberation. As to the factual issue itself, the appeal we've cited, I don't think that the facts are that complicated, and for the most part, they're agreed by all the parties. One is that this building is being constructed in the TR1 zone. The TR1 zone, when it lists its permitted uses, does not include a recreational facility. That's what this is designated to be, as a recreational facility. Because it's not a permitted use, then it's a prohibited use. According to Cedar Hills' ordinances, section 10-1-11, it says this: uses of land that are not expressly permitted within the zone are hereby declared to be expressly prohibited. So because it's not expressly permitted, it is expressly prohibited. There's also a non-conditional use permit that's been submitted here before this body, and again, as we walked into the hearing this evening, we were handed four documents we had not seen before, which simply highlights this issue of whether we have adequate notice to respond to certain things. But I looked through those four documents. I do not see a conditional use permit for a recreational facility in this particular zone. Because it's not a permitted use and it's not a conditional use, no building permit could be issued. And that was the error that was made. Now, the city, and I'm assuming you had an opportunity to read the city's brief that was submitted a couple of days ago, relies on language out of the intent section of the TR1 zone and says because there's a reference to recreational facility in the intent section, then it must be a permitted use within that zone. The Utah Supreme Court has been clear about this, that preambles and statements of intent in legislative enactments are not substantive law. They do not create substantive rights. And so you have to look at the substantive provisions of the statute or the ordinance to determine what rights have been granted or what rights have been prohibited. I would refer you to page 5 of the memoranda that I provided to you at the beginning, where we cite that at the bottom of the page, the language from the Utah Supreme Court. I'll just read that if you can follow along with me. It says, we have referred to a statement of legislative purpose as a preamble to the operative provisions of a statute, and we have held that as such, a preamble is nothing more than a statement of policy which confers no substantive rights. While some statutes have a policy section and some have a preamble, the effect to be given these provisions is the same. They provide guidance to the reader as to how the act should be enforced and interpreted, but they are not a substantive part of the statute. They may be used to clarify ambiguities, but they do not create rights that are not found within the statute, nor do they limit those actually given by the legislation. So the only time that the preamble or legislative intent would have any bearing at all is at a decision like we're talking about tonight, if there was some ambiguity in the ordinance. And there is no ambiguity here. There simply is not a permitted use for recreational facilities in this particular zone. So reference to the preamble or the intent language in that ordinance is not helpful to the city in trying to determine whether or not this building permit was wrongfully issued. The substantive portions of that ordinance, as you're well aware, are sections 2 and 3. Section 1 is the intent provision, section 2 is the permitted uses, and section 3 is the conditional uses. The permitted uses under section 2 indicate that whatever uses are permitted in the R1 15,000 zone would be permitted uses in the TR1 zone. As we've cited in the memorandum, and I'm sure you're probably aware, and there are In the R1 15,000 zone, recreational facilities are not permitted uses. So again, we refer back to the section of 10-1-11. If they're not specifically permitted, then they're specifically prohibited. So then you're left to look at the section 3, which is the town site residential project, which can be a conditional use in the TR1 zone. As you're well aware, a conditional use is an application to a planning commission. The planning commission then has an opportunity to review what is proposed, and they have three options. They can decline it, the proposal, they can accept the proposal as is, or they can impose conditions. We have seen no evidence that there was ever such a conditional use permit submitted to the planning commission, or that they had the opportunity to impose conditions or to make some restrictions as required by not only the city ordinances but by the state statutes. What we do know is that whatever would have been presented back in 2000 certainly would not be the same thing that's being proposed or that's being constructed by the city at this point. It was a private development. The plat map that I was handed as I walked in shows a clubhouse. It does not show what the design of that clubhouse is, but I think it's fair to assume that it certainly did not have the scope and the size of what is being built by the city now as they try to expand the use. And so I think that it can be safely said that what was ever proposed in that private development in 2000 for a clubhouse was not a public use building, it was not a recreation center, and that what is being proposed now is significantly greater in size and certainly in intensity of use, which would have been something that the Planning Commission in its conditional use, in its role as determining a conditional use permit, would have considered as size and intensity. That's not what happened, and certainly what we have here today is significantly different than what could possibly have been considered back then. So in essence, what you have here is a new project. And if the city's trying to get this new project approved as part of this large-scale development transitional residential project, they would have to come in with their own application and meet those requirements, which they cannot do, because the large-scale application or the large-scale residential, town site residential project requires 240 acres. This is a 7-acre site, and it requires it to be a residential development. That's not what this is being proposed to be. It's a recreation center open to the public for general use. So the bottom line of all of that is that we're in the TR1 zone. The TR1 zone does not allow recreational facilities as a permitted use, and there is no conditional use in existence or even one applied for to use this as a large-scale development with the requirements of having gone before the Planning Commission to obtain a conditional use permit. And as such, it was wrong for the zoning administrator to issue the building permit, and we request that you rescind that permit and stop the construction that's occurring on that site. If you have other questions, I'm willing to take a few of whatever questions you might have.
Okay, one question I want to ask. Why, would you address the concept of why you don't consider that area under the HOA as a residential development area?
Well, I think that in 2000, when it was constructed, obviously the homes that are there are a residential development. I think what my point is what you are dealing with today is an application or a building permit in the HOA. But it is true, it is in the HOA, but it's not connected. That application was not connected at all in any way, shape, or form to the other residential buildings there, because when it was approved in 2000, it was a private development for the clubhouse, not a recreational facility.
So your contention is that it does not, that, okay, it does meet the definition of being in the residential development zone, but that because it was not created when the development zone was created, it therefore is outside of the parameters of that conditional use.
Well, let's be clear that you and I are talking about the same thing.
Okay.
It's in the TR1 zone.
Yes.
Okay? There's no question it's in the TR1 zone.
Right.
So what's your question? Let's refer to it as the TR1 zone because that's what I've studied.
Okay, that's fine.
It's in TR1 zone. What's your question again, please?
Well, under the TR1 zone, it specifically says that townsite residential projects are conditional uses. It can be built as that.
That's true.
Okay. And you're telling me that this does... Okay. My thinking is that if it's an HOA, it's a townsite residential project, you're telling me it's not part of the townsite residential, even though you just told me that, yes, it is in that HOA area. So I'm confused why you're telling me it doesn't meet that requirement of the law.
Okay. Because you have to go through the TR1 zone, which says either a permitted use or a conditional use. And so when you're looking at the conditional use, there had to be an application for a conditional use permit. The application for the conditional use permit would have been, we want to treat this as the terms are too close, a townsite residential project. And so so it's not at least in the TR1 zone, you can't just have, because you apply for a townsite residential project, you're not entitled to that. You have to go through a conditional use permit if you're going to put one of those projects in the TR1 zone. That never happened here. There's nothing I can see in these documents to say that there was ever a conditional use permit applied for to put this townsite residential project in the TR1 zone. Now, if they wanted to put it into a different zone that didn't have that same restriction that said it was a conditional use permit, then you wouldn't have this issue about whether it's a conditional use permit or not. So in this particular case, there's no evidence that there was a conditional use permit in the 2000, and there certainly hasn't been an application for a conditional use permit in connection with this building permit.
Mr. Kane, do you have any questions?
Well, not being a lawyer and having little time to study the materials, I kind of sympathize with you in that regard. So if the ordinance requires a conditional use permit, you're stating that that was one, and I don't have any evidence to the contrary in that. So your point is that if we don't have a conditional use permit, then we can't proceed until with the building.
That's correct. Has to either be a permitted use or conditional use, and you don't have either.
And the permitted uses you stated earlier in your document are those lists at the bottom under footnote 2?
That's correct.
Okay.
And Chairperson, Mr. Chu, I believe we'll get an opportunity to also address this question as well, if you would like additional clarification.
Yeah, I would, because that's a miss. I don't really understand that situation well enough to really make a decision right now.
Maybe the first thing you addressed in your thing is your due process concerns.
Yes.
Maybe just expand a little bit on that. Is the concern the date, the time? In 20 years is the first time we've had attorneys at one of these meetings, so we're a little bit of a disadvantage. I don't believe that we do the normal discovery process, and I guess I wonder if we are fed information from one or both parties before this hearing happens. I don't know about the legal ramifications of taking that and having to use it for discovery and make it available to other people. I would assume that the information that we get in whatever manner is for our information, not necessarily has to be, you know, passed around.
Well, let me try to address it in this way. The issue we have is the time in order to respond and have the issues presented so that we can prepare to respond to those issues in a timely fashion. The request we made was for a week after we got the brief from the city. Obviously, with some of the things we've gotten today, there could be a need to look at some other things. My first answer is there's not a discovery process before the Board of Adjustments. We have an obligation to come forward with the evidence to support our case. The city comes forward with the evidence they have to support their case. In the ideal circumstance, from my perspective, is that those issues are presented by both parties well enough in advance of this hearing so that both parties feel like they've had an adequate opportunity to respond to it, and that you would have had an adequate opportunity to review the material and to ask the questions. So in my mind, what I had anticipated and what we have experienced in other venues is that the Board of Adjustments sets the hearing and lets everybody know well enough in advance, and there's a procedure. You have not adopted any rules or procedures that I've been able to find that govern this kind of procedure. Other communities have, which is that essentially you follow what they do in courts, which is the party who bears the burden, which would be us. We would submit our material by a certain date. The issues we think, this is a pretty straightforward issue. We think the application highlighted what it was. The city then comes back with their response within a certain amount of time, and then we get a rebuttal or to be able to respond to what the city has. And then all of that material is given to you well in advance of the hearing where you have an opportunity to study it, and we come back and then we argue our positions. And if you have some questions, we're in a position to be able to answer them. That's what we perceive to be and agree and believe to be the appropriate process, so that everybody has a fair and equal opportunity to be heard.
Okay, thanks. Just maybe for a little clarification, what has been normal for us in the past is the person bringing the action to the city has filled out the questionnaire with some specific questions about what are you worried about, you know, the list of concerns, I guess, and be very specific. That is pretty well all we get in advance to have your side of the story. Quite often the city has nothing. I mean, we sit down here when the meeting happens, we go through the concerns, then we start going over other things. I guess the issue I see with what we're talking about here is we get information from the city, we need to have you respond. Then they want to respond. This could go on forever. And I mean, we need to have some kind of a framework of doing it.
I agree. And like I said, I look for some rules and procedures here. You don't have those. Obviously, you haven't needed them in the past.
Mr. Carlin, I'm a little concerned by the fact that when Mr. Derringer filled out the application, he simply stated in a sentence or two that he believed that it was in violation of the zone, but gave no supporting evidence at that time. Previously, in all of the actions that we have dealt with, the applicant has at least listed some rationale for why, but that was lacking in this particular application. I would have thought that that could have been your initial first strike, if you will, of at least saying this is the area we're going to address and this is the way we're coming at it.
We filled that application out for Mr. Derringer, and we highlighted the issue, which was basically it's not a permitted use. It's very straightforward. It is not a permitted use. And therefore, the application should have been denied. There's really not much more to be able to say in that application. The memorandum we've given you today is to respond to what the city has come back with to try and argue that it is, for some reason, a permitted use. I agree that under there are different circumstances where we would have had a much more detailed application. We've done one recently with the Utah County Board of Adjustments, where we had 3-4 pages, I guess, attached to that. But it wasn't as simple an issue as this. It had some notice issues and some confusion in the county ordinances that said one thing in one place and one thing in a different place. So,
but since your viewing of Ms. Kite's brief, you've determined it's not as simple because you now have lots of documentation.
I still think it's as simple. But what we have to do is to address what we believe to be erroneous interpretation of the statute. For example, reliance on the intent provision. The Utah Supreme Court has said you don't rely on that. So we would not have addressed that in our application because we're aware of the Utah Supreme Court saying you don't look at intent statements. And so that's the kind of thing that why we're responding. It doesn't mean that we think it's any less simple than it was before. It's still a simple issue. No permitted use, no conditional use, therefore no building permit.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't miss anything, are you still requesting a continuance of this meeting?
I would request a continuance. I think that we've had an opportunity to adequately address the legal issue. We had to really move to do that, to be able to get this brief done in 2 days. I am not going to be able to answer that question until I hear Ms. Kite's response, because I don't know how she's going to respond to these 4 documents that she handed me coming in. I'm assuming at that point that in terms of the legal issues, we probably will not need to, but it depends on what how she argues these 4 documents. To me, the bigger concern is whether you have an adequate opportunity to digest the information and make your decision.
Walker, do you have any questions?
No. I'm just noticing that we did have Ms. Kite's report as of the 1st of August, and the notice didn't go out until the 2nd.
I can address that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carla.
Good evening, members of the board. Thank you for being here tonight. My name is Julia Kite. I am here on behalf of the City of Cedar Hills as private counsel. I am also one of the attorneys for the City of Cedar Hills with Peter Sturba of Sturba & Associates. We are here to discuss the application presented by Mr. Derringer on June 30th. In response to the submission on August 1st, we submitted it to the city. It's my understanding the city presented the full package on the 2nd. That was we may have provided it after 5:30. I don't know when the city closes. So in regards to our date of submission, that might have been the reason why it was presented in the package on the 2nd.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
There was some correspondence that I've read that indicated that you, I believe Mr. Carla addressed it in a letter that he sent to me, and also something to you, that there was email correspondence prior to this establishment of this date, and that your email correspondence to them about notification of the hearing was on July 29th.
Yes, it was.
But it was later?
I will address the full procedure of what has gone on.
Okay, because I think that's information I might know, but I don't believe the rest of the board knows.
Before I begin, I also have copies of all case law that is cited by Mr. Carlisle. If anyone wants those copies, I have complete copies. If some issues come up, please feel free. More than happy to hand them out. Regarding the issue of due process or adequate notice to Mr. Derringer, first and foremost, we agree with the board's position that the appellant, Mr. Derringer, has the burden of proving that an error occurred. When he submitted an application on June 30th that Mr. Derringer's counsel has conceded they filled out, that was his first opportunity. If we go to the city's memorandum, and if we address Exhibit A,
okay.
As part of the memorandum, we attached the City of Cedar Hill's Board of Adjustment application. It is regarding Mr. Derringer, and I'm going to refer to him going forward as the appellant in this matter. On June 30th, he submitted this document. In the document, it addresses summary of request. The summary states, rescind the building permit issued for construction of the community events and recreation center and stop all construction at the site. At the bottom, it says, there's an asterisk there. It says, please send all notices and correspondence of Mr. Derringer's attorney, to Mr. Derringer's attorney, Greg Carlisle, Ray Quinney Nebaker, 86 North University Avenue, number 430 Provo, Utah, 84601-4420, 801-342-2400, and then it lists Mr. Carlisle's email address, ccarlilerqn.com. On that same date, we contacted Mr. Carlisle and spoke and followed up with an email correspondence that was also provided via U.S. mail addressing our representation of the city. On a side note, we also agree with the board's position. We have not been retained as independent legal counsel for the board. We have done everything to, in fact, ensure impartiality and that no bias occurred to the board. We addressed this except for the city recorder's notification that is required by the ordinance and statute. There's been no other communication. We agree with the board on that. From that point forward, we communicated directly with Mr. Carlisle as we were requested to do. This goes into the due process where we agree the ordinances and the statute require that due process and adequate notice be provided to the appellant. With that said, on July 7th, we provided a four-page single-spaced letter to Mr. Carlisle where we addressed in detail the ordinances, the statutes, the Board of Adjustment, and the role we anticipated that this matter would take. Any claim that legal counsel was not aware of the issues that would be presented today, we believe is not justified. I have copies of that letter. If people would like to see it, I also can provide that to the board. Furthermore, in the memorandum of the appellant, there are some questions in cases that are stated addressing these concerns. Specifically, Mr. Carlisle referred us to page 5 of the memorandum, and he actually read a quote from one of the cases that they cited regarding what the legislative intent and what kind of weight that should hold. I would like to address those two cases. The first was the Dairy Product Services, Inc., the City of Wellsville, and the second is NRA adoption of SLF. First of all, as you may guess, the second case, NRA adoption, is regarding an adoption statute. It has no application to this case. We would ask that you ignore that. The second matter, Dairy Product Services. In Dairy Product Services, it states, where defendants have had notice of hearing before a council and judicial review of its action, they have had all that they are entitled to procedurally. Questions have come up about whether it's appropriate in regards to discovery or other issues. There is the public and open meeting requirement that are listed in the ordinances. The city has addressed that the Board of Adjustment and any hearings are to be held in accordance with that open and public meeting requirement. That meeting requirement only requires 24-hour notice. That is it. We provided, as Ms. Leek has addressed, on July 29th, we provided as a courtesy when the city recorder confirmed with myself that there was a quorum available, we notified Mr. Carlisle via email. There was no hidden agenda. There was no hastily convened meeting. We simply, as a professional courtesy, addressed that with him. There had been that was the third email that was sent. There had been no prior indication that the emails were not getting to council or anything to put us on notice that mail was the only way to provide notice to the appellant. In fact, based on that application, there was an email provided to give us reasonable belief it was appropriate to send it to Mr. Carlisle via email. instead on Monday, and as I addressed, I don't know when our brief was provided to the city recorder, but I believe it was on Monday night. On Tuesday the 2nd, it was provided. The legal assistant at our firm provided the package. Nothing was responded to. Mr. Carlisle had an opportunity to respond to us on July 7th. He also received that document via mail. No correspondence or any argument that we believe your position's wrong. Let's see if we can address this beforehand. Mr. Derringer is also, although I believe retired, maintains an active attorney's license. These are not unsophisticated entities here, or individuals in this case. It was reasonable for us to anticipate from the application that was provided almost 2 months ago on June 30th that the appellant would provide something. And it is his duty. It is his duty, not the city's duty. We are responding to an application and a request to rescind a validly issued building permit. Personal opinions, objections aside, it is an objective analysis where we are focused on the statutes and ordinances that were addressed earlier. Earlier, there were ordinances addressed and statutes addressed, where the Board of Adjustment is to focus on the evidence presented to it today. It can decide, as there have been questions, that if they want to hold off on their final decision, but there is no legal requirement in regards to discovery, in regards to these other issues. It is an open and public meeting. It is designed that way. We are here on behalf of the city to address the issues that have come up because on June 30th, when that application was filed, it was filed by an attorney. Mr. Derringer brought in an attorney first. There was no private attorney brought in to address Mr. Derringer. With that said, the cases I started referring to in regards to the notice of hearing. When a Board of Adjustment hearing is determined to be fair and impartial, these are the other elements that you're to consider to decide if due process had in fact been informed or afforded. Continuing with the Dairy Product Services quote. With respect to an ordinance declaring their property to be a nuisance, that's the basis of the case. It is also not necessarily applied to this case because it's dealing with a nuisance ordinance, not what we're here for today. But moving on, to be considered a meaningful hearing, the concerns of the affected party should be heard by an impartial decision maker. As addressed earlier, we believe the board is impartial and have worked hard on our part. In fact, the first contact made by either attorney was by appellant's counsel, at which point we then clearly indicated in our response to him that we would forward our response on regarding this issue of an extension. We believe the Board of Adjustment, having full-time jobs, other responsibilities, or just being responsible citizens, should not have to balance their schedule, readdress an issue when you guys have committed to this hearing and the appellant filed the application over 2 months ago. In addition, it is also helpful to have a record. As we've addressed, we've submitted evidence. Any evidence that is to be heard by a court is based on what is heard here. It is open and transparent. That prevents parties from submitting after the fact. Here is the additional documentation. Here is it. It is to allow all parties a fair ground. In regards to time of production, there is no requirement, but we would assert that the appellant has had 2 months. And the fact that they chose to wait, even though both parties were aware that legal counsel were involved, was their own choice.
Ms. Kite, I would just like to clarify that from June 30th to August 4th is probably closer to 5 weeks than 2 months. But
I appreciate that, and you are absolutely correct. Thank you. Regardless, a substantial amount of time, I think most anyone, lawyer or not, would agree. But thank you. I apologize. I don't mean to misstate that. In regards to the issue of notice, the ordinances and other case law address what is correct notice. That case that I was just citing, Dairy Product Services, the notice they provided there is what was provided in their ordinances. Their ordinances provided, I believe it was September, the end of September, the first week of October, and without having the case in front of me, I believe it's a very short time period, and they went by what their specific ordinance said. Their specific ordinance, I think, had a 14-day time frame in there. Our specific ordinance addresses the open and public meetings, 24-hour notice. No other requirement. This is not a special meeting. It's an open and public meeting slash hearing, depending on the term. Statutes refer to it typically the hearing. Ordinance refer to it more as a meeting. As addressed, we have provided correct notice. It was well before the 24-hour requirement. Even with the provision of the package on the 2nd, it is still well within 24 hours. I'd like to get into the actual basis of why we're here today and the facts behind it. The city asserts that there is absolutely an incorrect position being presented to you today regarding the conditional use. We believe that the community recreation center is within the conditional permitted uses, and we will go through, I'm going to go through step by step and address why it is. In 2000, a recreational facility was being considered. We have given to you the resolution, and I would ask that you take a look at that. Resolution number 66-2000C. In that resolution, it is setting the impact fee amount for the City of Cedar Hills Park and Recreational Facilities impact fee. Since as early as 2000, the city has been considering and put into documentation that they are considering and want a recreational facility. That is why the impact fee was created. That is why it was being collected. This goes through and identifies the recreational facility intent. The reason I address this is because if we turn to the appellant's memorandum, and if we turn to pages 8, previously this evening, Mr. Carlisle indicated that this isn't a conditional use because it wasn't done recently. In his memorandum, it's actually exactly the opposite. They have argued, it appears that the CORC, or Community Recreation Center, had not been planned or even designed or conceptualized when the initial development of the community surrounding the CORC property occurred approximately 10 years ago. There is no indication that the developer of the project had plans of constructing the CORC, and to appellant's knowledge, the entitlement and approvals issued by the city to the original community developer were not conditioned upon the construction of a facility similar to the court. Similar to the court. This is, in fact, not the case. There were several documented things that indicate that it was considered in as early as 2000, so longer than 10 years ago. Hopefully my math is correct there. But I would like to go through that because what the appellant has argued in his memorandum has now tried to back away from in our discussion here this evening. Apart from the resolution number 66-2000, there's also ordinance 97-2000. I would like us to focus on this in particular. The reason that these documents were provided today, and we would assert there are three documents that were provided in response to the appellant's brief, because we wanted to resolve this issue based on the arguments raised there. The fourth is simply a Google map. It is not a material issue, it's a demonstrative, and I'll address that in a second. Going through the ordinance number 97-2000, an ordinance granting approval of the final plat and appurtenant materials of the Cedars Plant residential development located at approximately 10500 North and 4000 West. It goes down what the city of Cedar Hills have required to do. It says, whereas. It then says, now, therefore, be it ordained by the City Council of Cedar Hills, Utah County, State of Utah, as follows. It addresses part one, development approved, planned residential project. Beneath that, it addresses the final plat A. That is not the plat we are here to discuss today, so I am going to move down that. Moving to part two, I would like you to circle, star, or do whatever regarding this part. It says part two, development approved townsite residential development. The final plats B, C, and D of the Cedars townsite residential development as set forth on Exhibit B is hereby approved. It then goes through the adoption of the plat. It includes plat B. If you flip three pages, plat B is identified. This is the plat that we are here to address today. Furthermore, on the first page, I would like to go back to that first page and focus again on another specific area. The second whereas, the Cedar Hills City Council, following receipt of a recommendation from the Planning Commission, has determined that it is in the best interest of Cedar Hills and the residents thereof to grant final approval to the Cedars Plan residential development. In 2000, the entire area, land use, including Plat B that's at issue, was put before the Planning Commission, was appropriately approved, and was put into effect via an ordinance. This is further demonstrated on the map. Earlier, appellant's counsel said this shouldn't apply because it says clubhouse. What is identified in their memorandum is that there was no facility, similar recreational facility, considered at this time. If you look at the drawing with Hubble Engineering at the bottom, if you go almost straight up, you will see it says clubhouse site. Similar location, if not the same location, since it's so far out, there was at the same time in 2000, the facility was contemplated. There was support via the recreation facility impact fee, there was support via the ordinance, and there's support here. It falls under the TR Town residential site. Wait.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Moving ahead, I would like to get right into those ordinances so that you can see the connection. Derringer's counsel disregards the legislative intent that is addressed in the initial ordinance of Ordinance 10. Mr. Carlisle addressed two specific cases. He had addressed Price Development Co., LP v. Orange City, and Wesley v. Board of City Commissioners of Salt Lake to support their premise that we should disregard it because it's a preamble. That is not accurate. Mr. Carlisle omits one of the other Utah Supreme Court cases that actually addresses when a preamble is relevant to demonstrate legislative intent. And in that case, it is the case of Berisholt v. Salt Lake City Corporation. In that case, they said the legislative intent was helpful. Furthermore, I'd like to point out something. If we turn to page 5 of Mr. Carlisle's memorandum, he read to us a quote. He addressed the preamble, and it is highlighted, but they are not a substantive part of the statute. He is referencing case law that's addressing statutes, not ordinances. We are looking at ordinances to determine whether the building permit issued on May 16th, 2011 was correctly issued.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
In all fairness, you indicated why the previous cases that he'd cited did not apply. tell me more information about the case you just cited, Barthold versus Salt Lake City Corporation?
Correct.
Why is that similar, and why should we say that that applies?
What I would say is his cases do not apply at all. In the event that they do, and I think I have that in my outline, in the event that we are applying them, we should also look at Barthold, which is the Supreme Court's opinion as when a legislative preamble does apply. And in that case, if we are addressing statutes, you can look at the entire act or statute, and I would analyze that to what we have here. Here, with a set of ordinances, I believe we should look at the entire ordinance to determine what was intended, just like they do in the statute. If Mr. Carlisle presented that there's no ambiguity here, well, there might not be a ambiguity in the sense that there's not one word here that says red and the other one here that says blue, but you can consider the legislative intent section as an indication of what's to come and what is intended further down the line. I don't think you should use them at all. If you are going to use them, I would just point out the Supreme Court, Utah Supreme Court, has found cases where the legislative preamble is useful.
Thanks.
Moving through that vein, the next statute. We've spent time talking about the TR1 zone. I would like to go to the TR1 zone. We can go for reference, if we go to Mr. Deringer's attachment, he has provided those. And if we get to the page 1 of 2, if we're looking for it in the attachment, Article 1, TR1, Townsite Residential Zone. Have we found it?
Which exhibit is it?
It is exhibit B, and it's
okay.
Keep going.
They're in numerical order.
Keep going.
The ordinance is on that exhibit in numerical order.
It's page 8.
Keep
are
going.
We
go for this.
Right there, okay. Yep.
So as I was discussing, in TR1 townsite residential zone, we have the legislative intent. We have previously established that within that legislative intent, it does address a community facility. Going down to B, specifically says, the same page, but just going down to that B paragraph, it should be noted in the legislative intent, owners and developers of property within this zone should bear in mind that primacy is given to residential development and other complementary facilities such as schools, churches, recreational facilities, and open space, and should maintain their properties in recognition thereof. Moving down the page to permitted uses, we agree that is not where the use comes into effect. What we focus on is 10.413, where it says conditional uses. And it goes through onto the next page, the very last line, says townsite residential project subject to the provisions of Chapter 6, Article D of this title. We then need to go to Chapter 6, Article D of this title. I do not believe that Mr. Carlisle has addressed the permitted uses under that article, under 62 and 64, with the appropriate weight it should be given. I would like to address first and foremost 1064, minimum project area. The appellant has focused on that the minimum base area required to qualify for a planned townsite project shall be 240 acres. He fails to add on the additional language subsequent additions to an existing planned townsite project shall have no minimum area requirement, except that any such addition shall constitute a logical design extension of the planned townsite project. There is no requirement. It was an approved townsite residential project, has been since 2000. Further, any argument that, well, that's just the land, it's not what's built on top of the land, we go up to 1060-2, permitted uses. It says, the following buildings, structures, and uses of land may be permitted within a planned townsite project. There is a line that says any use permitted within the underlying zone and those authorized under this section. Beneath that, it says, common areas and recreational facilities, public and private. There was a presentation earlier that there was some distinction that if something was private to start, it somehow shouldn't count if it's public now. It does not matter. The ordinance provides public and private, and it goes on, including but not limited to golf courses, swimming pools, tennis courts, clubhouses, recreational buildings, landscapes, pond areas and features, and similar recreational facilities for the use and enjoyment of these residents. This is absolutely a permitted use. The appellant has stated that at the beginning of his memorandum that the zoning administrator, in this case the building official, could only do what was expressly permitted within the ordinances. We have gone through and identified that since 2000, this was a residential townsite project. The building, regardless, has been considered since 2000, whether it is a clubhouse, whether it is a fitness gym, whether it is a golf entity in and of itself, it falls under a recreational purpose. Also, the application, I provided for you a map. I want to reiterate the fact that your job as a board of adjustment is simply to look at the decision of whether the building inspector, in this case, Mr. Brad Pearl, properly issued a permit on May 16, 2011. I draw your attention to this map for the simple purpose that on the application, there were four individuals that were listed on Sawgrass. I provided this map to indicate where the clubhouse location is, as well as the first address listed on that application. You will find that the addresses listed on Sawgrass are on the opposite end of where the clubhouse location is. Any claim that those people are suffering a direct injury, we believe, is not relevant or applicable. We wanted to address it because they're listed there. Also, Mr. Pearl. Mr. Pearl has been an inspector for 12 years. We attached as another exhibit to our memorandum the application that was issued, the permit application made by the city. We provide a little bit of history for the board to consider. This issue has been going on for a long time. It is convoluted, and that's why we are just here, as Mr. Carlisle, to address. It is a simple issue. We are only looking at the building permit. That is it. The building permit arose after some significant steps. 2000, recreation facility was addressed. Thereafter, there were significant discussions. More relevant, 2006, 2007, 2009, in open council meetings, there were discussions about recreation facilities. In 2010, the mayor went to the great length of establishing the Blue Ribbon Committee. He did it to gain input from the residents. There's been every effort made to make sure that this is an open and transparent process. In June of 2010, that committee was created. The appellant was on that Blue Ribbon Committee. He has been aware of these issues easily, but at least since 2010. 2011, there were recommendations made by the Blue Ribbon Committee. The end of 2010, the architect came in and gave some hard numbers, some realistic numbers of, hey, this is what things will actually cost, different than people's wish list, hope. At the end of the day, you have to make some hard decisions. Open council meetings continued, and there was continued discussion into January of 2011. February of 2011, the city accepted the lowest bid for a recreation facility. In March and thereafter, either the appellant and or different individuals for the citizens group were responsible, Group for Responsible Government, I believe, presented several petitions, referendums. They have continued to address this issue. In April of 2011, the city, via a motion, approved the contract with the construction company. After that time, there were continued interactions with the city, which then led up to the June 30th application. Again, this is not an issue that just came out of the blue where we're not affording the appellant an opportunity to address his concerns. The city went to further lengths to ensure there's been claims that the proper review did not occur. Well, not only was it properly approved in 2000, but as addressed earlier, as part of the HOA, the city presented plans that were approved by the Cedars HOA Association, HOA, the Homeowners Association. In addition, it was presented to the Cedars Architectural Review Committee for approval. Finally, the building inspector was presented an application. The city, after getting the approval from all possible entities, got the application done on May 10th. On May 15th, Mr. Curl properly issued a permit. He is also here and available today. If there are any questions regarding whether he did his due diligence, he did do his due diligence. He reviewed the evidence, which is what you are to do based on the case law and what we've presented to you today. You are to put yourself near or in the shoes of the building inspector and find if what he did was reasonable. We would ask that you put all personal, as fellow residents, put that aside. It's a very serious responsibility, but if you look at what occurred and go through the elements of whether it is a permitted conditional use, the permit was applied to the Community Recreation Center, and it was a permitted and approved use. If there are any questions, I'm more than happy to hear them. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cheney, do you have any questions?
Yeah. I've actually lived here for a number of years and covered practically the entire period of time that you've discussed. And the original intent was to build a recreational facility, but on the opposite end of the town. That property up there was never considered for anything more than a clubhouse, in my personal experience, until just recently. So while the intent was there to build one, it's always been indicated that it would be over on 40, close to 4800 West.
Could I address your comment?
Sure.
In regards to, as I recognize, there's been a long history regarding this, and as the board, what your position is almost to take out the history
right.
and address what's been presented.
Sure, and I agree with that.
And in regards to, I think everyone in this room understands that there has been different things that have gone on. But in regards to the specific issue of whether the building permit was an appropriate permit, there is no prevention of either party going forward to the district court to review this. And that is why it is an intermediate step. It gives the parties an opportunity to review, essentially, the evidence, and then decide, okay, do I want to proceed further? Your decision is focused on whether there was evidence to support the building inspector's issuance of the permit.
For the moment.
All right.
It's your turn. One of Mr. Derringer's attorney's comments was the conditional use permit. Your assertion is that's not even an issue because it's a permitted use?
What my position is that if you go to the conditional use, and we would you mind if we looked at it again?
Yes, please.
Sure.
To be accurate, I don't want to misrepresent what it says. So if we first of all go back to that CR1, and we move past the legislative intent.
Okay.
We move past the permitted uses, and we note it says conditional uses. The following building structures and uses of land shall be permitted upon compliance. There is no permit issued, and I may have Mr. Curl address this, if you wouldn't mind, afterwards, just to make sure I'm accurate, but there's no permit by this ordinance, but it does say, when we turn to that next provision, townsite residential project and directs us then to there. When we go to that provision and it talks about express permitted uses, and that's where we get to common areas, public and private, specifically golf courses, swimming pools, recreational buildings, clubhouses. So that would be our position, is that you need to follow, you don't just get to stop at the start where it says conditional uses, you have to follow it all the way through to the 60-10-2.
Well, this is actually different from a different section of the ordinances, which deals with large-scale development. It doesn't address particularly the Tier 1.
What is, where the jump is when I mentioned in the Tier 1, so where we go conditional uses, and we get to that town site residential project subject to the provisions of Chapter 6. So we have to tie those together. We can't just jump into Chapter 6, Article D, without tying those together. And then when you go from the townsite residential project to the permitted uses, the townsite residential project is in effect here, and it has been since 2000. It's approved by the ordinance. It is a residential project. And then addressing the issue of the minimum project area, where we went over that any expansion of that area, although I don't think that's necessarily applicable here. I think that ordinance is more designed like if you have a specific piece of land and if you extend out over here, I think that is more what it's addressing. But I just think that it supports the permitted use is expressed. It is an express permitted use within the TR1.
Well, as I see it, it looks like we've got a conflict in the ordinances in the city then between 10-4-I-1 and this 6 Article B?
I think because it would be the city's position, and I'm going to have Mr. Pearl identify and address this because he is the expert on this. It wouldn't be a conflict. It's just this is binding to the TR1 zone.
Right.
And that provision is binding to the TR1 zone and is a specific permitted use.
Well, it sounds like that Section 6 actually occurs to any development throughout the city.
Right.
Which, anywhere in the city, that's different than just in a TR1 zone. And I think you're making exclusions based on a general statement versus what's in a specific zone.
Well, this zone addresses the residential project. Look, it says the planned town site, 240 acres, and that's what was approved in 2000. And so
I believe if what you're saying then is that the townsite residential project is one of the conditional uses under the TR1 zone.
Yes.
And that then further clarification of what constitutes townsite residential projects and the buildings within it is what's found in Chapter 6.
Yes.
And so not so much that it's a conflict, but that the definition of that is not in Chapter 4, or, yeah, Chapter 10.
Chapter 10.4 is found
in Chapter 10.6.
And I believe that would be an appropriate way to address the way those tie together.
Well, it sounds like we may disagree on that point.
Mr. Lynch, would you have any more questions?
No, that was it.
Mr. Walker, do you have questions?
No, I think we're really saying then that this minimum project area is the TR1 area, and it was approved back in 2000.
Correct. And even more, with the 62... regardless of the minimum area, it is further expressly allowed in the permitted uses of 1062. And if it would be permitted, I would just have Mr. Pearl address.
Yes, I was going to ask for his input anyway.
So absolutely.
That would be fine. But I'll ask you in a moment. I'd like to have Mr. Carlisle. Would you like, are you finished, Ms. Kaye?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank you.
Would you like to address any rebuttal of any issues at the time?
Yes, I'm wondering if I hear
you want
Mr.
to
Crow
listen to that first. Okay.
That too.
Then, Mr. Crow, please.
Sure.
Specifically, one of the things we would like clarified is, does the town of Cedar Hills have a provision for something known as a conditional use permit? And if they do, is it different from a traditional building permit? And if they don't, then why does the traditional building permit cover all of those types of parameters?
Traditional building permit does cover all those parameters. I think we're kind of playing with the word permit and permitted uses. This facility, when we looked under Chapter 10 of Article 1, or 4.1-1, and it talks about the legislative intent, and then we went down to permitted uses. They were not applicable. We went right down to conditional uses, which doesn't mean that you actually apply for a conditional use permit, to answer your question. It has to meet these conditional uses to be permitted, not to receive a building permit per se. Is that fair? So it references, like the attorney stated, that the townsite residential projects are subject to the conditions set forth in Chapter 6, Article 10 of this title. So then when you go to large-scale development, we've all been through that, it talks about what is permitted under those conditions, and that's when it addresses under the permitted uses of a clubhouse or recreational facility. Any other questions?
Anything else you want to add?
No, it's pretty straightforward, okay, in my opinion.
Gentlemen?
Were you in favor of the project initially?
In favor of it? I think that's irrelevant. I have to look for the ordinances, and if it meets the ordinances, if I'm in favor or not, it's not my decision.
Now, question, then, in the 2000 approval, what was that just a blanket approval for whatever might be built in that area?
You would have to ask the council that was there that drew up that ordinance. I didn't write the ordinance. So like it was stated before, when they talked about this minimum project area, they were development of that plateau, so to say, and that's what they had come up with. And so they wanted to look at all the applicable uses and what they could use that property for, and so on and so forth. And that's why they came up with the master plan of how they wanted to go forward with that. Yes? Do you have a question?
No.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. Carlock?
Thank you. I'm going to try to do this in as organized a way as I can, given the number of issues that have been raised. I want to make certain that I understood what Mr. Curl just said, because if I understood it the way he said it, I absolutely disagree with it. And that is, when the ordinance says it's a conditional use, there is a body that determines what those conditions are, and that's the Planning Commission. And so in order to have a conditional use, you're going to have to make an application to the Planning Commission, who will then consider all consider the proposal and the input from the community and whatnot, and then determine whether to approve it, deny it, or set conditions on it. And so what I understood Mr. Curl to say was that it's just happened. In essence, what I heard Mr. Curl say is that any conditional use is a permitted use. And that's certainly not true. It's only conditional because it gets presented to the Planning Commission, because they can place appropriate restrictions to meet some of the adverse effects that the project may have. I will agree that with Ms. Kite, that the history of the city in terms of considering a recreational facility is irrelevant. That happened to be about 90% of her presentation. And so I'm going to have to address some of it in my rebuttal. But I do disagree with her statement that the standard that you look at is whether Mr. Curl's decision was reasonable. We're not here casting any aspersions on Mr. Curl. We're saying he's a fine individual, diligent, and good in what he does. We just claim he made an error here. And so the question isn't whether it was reasonable. The question is whether it was legal. And that's what you're called upon to decide today, is whether it was legal. As to the conditional use, and I think now we've agreed that nobody's talking about this in terms of permitted use. Nobody's saying it's a permitted use. So as to a conditional use, if you get into the history of all of this that was presented by Ms. Kite, look at the one exhibit that she had, which is resolution number 6-6-2000C. And you can look down and look at the assumptions, what was being considered at that time. Look under assumption E, it's a pool and a rec center. You look down at M, it's a pool and a rec center. It's a completely different project than what was eventually 10 years later approved with the building permit for construction. So we don't doubt that the city has for some time wanted a recreational facility. That's not the issue here. The question is whether it was appropriate to build it in this zone, and as we've said before, it is not. Before I go into that in detail, let me first address these due process issues and then move into what I think you really want to consider, but I do need to make sure the record is clear on this. Ms. Kite did send to me in my office on July 29th, a copy of the memoranda that's been filed on behalf of the city. It came at 6:09 Friday night, went to my junk mail folder, so I didn't see it even on Monday, but I would not have seen it until Monday anyway, because it was sent after business hours. What was troubling to us was that she knew this hearing, the date of the hearing, and was the one that actually informed us before we ever got notice from the Board of Adjustments. That is the impartiality that we've talked about before. Whether she's represented you or not, there is an issue there. Now, on the case law that we've cited, due process is not a function of the nature of the issue being presented. It's not a function of whether it's a divorce. It's not a function of whether it's a civil lawsuit for breach of contract. It's not a function of whether it's a criminal case. Due process is due process. and it requires that people have a meaningful opportunity, adequate notice, and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. So you can't dismiss it out of hand because it's a divorce case, and if you read those cases, they don't say that this is the standard that applies in a divorce case as opposed to other cases. As to the idea that perhaps we think there's a hidden agenda, we don't accuse anybody of a hidden agenda. I want that to be clear. We don't think anybody has tried to do that. We do think that it's just a new situation for all concerned, and that the distinction between counsel for the city and counsel for the Board of Adjustments wasn't recognized as well as it should have been. I will represent that just because the Open Meetings Act allows somebody to have, or the city to give a 24-hour notice, I would challenge anybody to find a court case that says the 24-hour notice is a meaningful opportunity to be heard. We asked for an additional week. The case that she cited was a 14 days. We certainly think that that's an indication of what would have been appropriate. And you cannot undermine due process by setting an unreasonable amount of time to respond to whatever is being presented. So I think that adequately addresses our concerns about the conditional use. What you do not have, the conditional use, the due process, what you do not have before you this evening is a conditional use permit. There wasn't one. And so when they're relying on conditional use as the basis for this facility, they are required to come forward with a conditional use permit. Now, I think there's been a false confusion created about these ordinances. I wish I had a whiteboard, and so I'm just going to try to do it without a whiteboard. But you have the TR1 zone, and it says these are permitted uses and these are conditional uses. The conditional use is what's over in 6D in these large-scale developments here. So over here in 6D, by the way, if you read that language, it says that these the following buildings, structures, and uses of land may be permitted. So it doesn't say they shall be permitted, so they may be permitted. And it's part of the approval process in these large-scale developments. The developer comes in, presents a plan, and then the staff and the city, they work together on what this thing ought to eventually look like. And it says these are some things that may be considered there. But back on the conditional use issue, you've got the TR1 zone that says, as a conditional use, is anything over here in this township residential project. Over in township residential project, this could apply to different zones. In fact, my understanding is it applies to the hillside zone. But I don't know if it's a conditional use in the hillside zone or if it's a permitted use. But in any event, at any point, it could be a permitted use in any zone. So over here, you have these uses that may be used. But in order to get these uses, whether you call them permitted or otherwise, as applicable in the TR1 zone, you've got to go through the conditional use process, which is you've got to take your plan to the county or to the planning commission and get a conditional use permit for that particular zone. They don't have that here. They've got an approval by the city of this town site residential, but they do not have a conditional use permit. And it's inappropriate and improper, or I shouldn't say it that way, It's inaccurate to say that if assume for a moment they had a conditional use permit in 2000. What did they have a conditional use permit for? It certainly wasn't the rec center that was being considered when the impact fee was adopted, because that had a pool with it and apparently was being considered at a different end of town. And so what went before the Planning Commission was something significantly different than what is before you today. And so what went to the Planning Commission, so that the Planning Commission could look at the intensity of the use, was something significantly different to this, and they made it, if they made a decision, which we have no evidence that they did, because there's no conditional use permit here, it was the conditions that were on that building, I won't speculate, but they didn't set conditions that would apply to this particular building. That was a building that was a private building. I'm not saying the private and it makes a difference whether it's a private development or not, other than to say that the use would have been a much less intense use. And that's what the Planning Commission looks for when they're doing conditional use permits, is density and intensity, usually, and establishing those conditions. So what we do know is that if an individual gets a conditional use permit for a particular use intensity, he's not at liberty, he or she, or not at liberty at that point to substitute another use. Just because they've got a conditional use doesn't mean that they can take another use and substitute it, because it was specific to the Planning Commission and the conditions were specific to that particular use. And that's what the city's trying to do here. They're assuming, first of all, that there was a conditional use permit, and now they're saying because there was a conditional use permit, we can take any recreational facility, regardless of size and intensity, and we can plug it in there, and we're approved. That's not true. The conditions are specific to that specific application, and the Planning Commission has to have the opportunity to look at intensity and density and those kinds of things and the impact on the neighborhood. The case of this is Baratol versus Salt Lake City in terms of legislative intent. Let me go back and have you read with me again the the language on page 5 that we quoted from the Utah Supreme Court. The last part of the quoting there at the bottom, page 5, right there at the end, after the ellipsis, just before you go to the next page. They, meaning the preambles in the legislative intent sections, may be used to clarify ambiguities, but they do not create rights that are not found within the statute, nor do they limit those actually given by the legislation. I haven't read the Baratol case. I don't know what its site is. I don't know the date on it. But what I suspect is that there was something in that statute that was ambiguous. And so, therefore, they looked to the legislative intent as stated to try to clarify that ambiguity. You never look at intent unless you first find that there's an ambiguity. And there is no ambiguity in the TR1 zone. This is not a permitted use, and if you're going to do a conditional use, then you've got to go through the appropriate process to do that, meaning that over those residential township residential project. So I we haven't misrepresented any case law to you. We think it's pretty clear what that is, and in this particular case, the result is the same. It was a permitted use, and it didn't have a conditional use, and therefore the building permit was wrongfully issued. Thank you.
Thank you. And if we will be brief, I would just like to
One issue.
May I start it and have Mr. Curl finish it?
Yes.
Okay. We would just like to address the point of the conditional use. We are two lawyers. And as you've indicated, there's never been lawyers presented. There are legal, conceptual issues, and at the end of the day, it comes down to what is done and what the city had authority to do. And I believe Brad Curl can address this issue of a permit or conditional use as he was the inspector at the time. Thank you.
In addressing the conditional use permit, as throughout our other zones in the city, we do have conditional uses in every zone. There's permitted uses, which means that if somebody on their own wants to meet certain requirements, they can go ahead and do so, and it's permitted. There's also conditional uses that are usually a bit more restrictive, but it's up to me to decide if they meet those conditions and therefore give authorization to have them go ahead. Case in point, we've had the small animal ordinance recently come up before us that allows a conditional use in every zone for people to have chickens, for example. If they meet the certain conditions of the distances from the properties to the neighboring houses and so on and so forth, then they're allowed to have chickens up to a certain amount, to a certain square footage. It's up to me to review that to make sure it meets those requirements, it meets those conditions. There isn't a separate permit for that. There isn't an application where it has to go through the city, the Planning Commission, and so on and so forth. It's done all that. it's been written up that here are the conditions. If they meet the conditions, it's up to me being the governing authority to review that to make sure that it meets those conditions, and therefore it's able to proceed.
So are you indicating that there is a history of past practice where when a conditional use is being utilized in a particular zone, that you, in your role as
the building official, and zoning administrator,
you are the one who makes that decision, and there's a history that that has been consistent and done previously for a while?
For the 12 years that I've been here with Cedar Hills, that's the way it's been.
As the ex-officio board member, I won't vote as dictated by the ordinance, but I would like to ask a question.
Certainly.
So, Brad, can you give us an example, a concrete example of what you just said?
As it relates to the conditional use of being permitted, I can give you an example of recently we had an issue with small animal ordinances, and we had an instance where the parties surrounding the people who had the offending animals came in, and there was a point where it needed to be reviewed. And it was addressed. We looked at the ordinance. We saw that it met the ordinance. They wanted to come through, and as you know, in City Council, they have that opportunity to come before the council and discuss any concerns if they feel like there was an injustice. And we do have an appeal process in place for those sort of situations. But it was a simple case that I see that if it meets the conditional use as previously set forward by the City Council, who has the land use authority to decide how that is best to be designed, if it meets what the City Council has previously stated, then it's going to be permitted. Not permitted in the sense that physically with a building permit, but it meets the conditions, so therefore it's permitted to move forward as a project.
And so this did not have to go before the Planning Commission. You are the one who has the authority.
It had already been through the process before it came to my desk.
Okay.
I re-review the process to make sure all the T's are crossed and that is adopted. But it had already gone through the process. As you are well aware, at a Blue Ribbon Committee, at Planning Commission, with the Council, so on and so forth. Once it was all drawn up, then it goes to my desk. Because before then, it's just an idea until it's actually on paper and they submit an application for a building permit. Not a conditional use permit. It's already gone through the process, and I make sure that it meets the conditional use as intended in the ordinance.
So in the City of Cedar Hills, we do not issue conditional use permits?
No.
I have a question. Here in that same section, in the TR1,
yes,
under conditional use, and it says the following building structures and uses of land shall be permitted upon compliance with the applicable requirements of this title and after approval has been given by the designated review agency. Now, who is that compliance approving agency or person or group, and has there been an approval by a designated review agency? Because if you'll notice, that's the main heading. Everything else is now indented from there, which means everything else, including townsite residential projects, subject to the provisions of Chapter 6, Article D. So that says if we go over here to the other section, there's already been somebody that has looked at this and said it complies, it has met the approval, and has been given the designated review agency.
Right.
Do we have that in this case?
Yes, we have the City Council that has that authority over the use of the land. And if you want to go back to Section 10-1-11, which the appellant was addressed at the very beginning of this discourse, talked about uses prohibited in zones unless expressly permitted. It specifically cites that on the third line down, except as may be permitted by action of the Planning Commission or City Council.
Okay.
They gave their governing authority and allowed that to go through the process to meet their conditions, and if they drew up the plans, and then it came to my office.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this rightly, 11 years ago, we had a homeowners association in this development that was going to have a clubhouse, and it was approved. And now, 11 years later, we're putting not a clubhouse on here, but something we're calling a rec center. And it's within a private development of a homeowners association, because one of the things we say here is that we have the board of directors of that homeowners association's approval.
We did that more as a customary. I don't believe that we actually had to get that, other than it's part of that town site zone. And so we went to the HOA board and we presented it to them. They reviewed it. They put in their ideas and what they wanted to see and such, and gave their stamp and signature of approval. That was actually also before it came to my desk.
I guess the only thing I'm a little concerned about is that we're sliding a monster in here. The camel's got in the tent when we called it a clubhouse, and it was from a homeowners association. And I'm familiar with HOAs.
Mm-hmm.
But it was approved as an HOA project, as a private deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 11 years later, we're making it a whole city of Cedar Hills, including in this project, and they're still signing off on it.
Yes,
and the city council signing off on
yes.
it.
Yes.
Are they paying for it? Is the HOA paying for the
facility? We will not address that issue at this time. Thank you.
Okay.
But you're right. The original HOA, they did approve it as a clubhouse, and now it's a multi-purpose facility. Again, it's gone through the re-review of that, and being a similar structure, it still meets the zone. It still meets the ordinance within the zone and the conditions that were set forth. And so it went through the process of the Planning Commission and City Council, and the HOA still approved it and reviewed it. And
So the Planning Commission has given their approval on this?
Oh, yes.
Any other questions?
Okay. Lots of Brad. No, I'm done with Brad.
Okay.
I'm done with you, Brad.
Thank you very much.
Are we on the board discussion part now?
We're almost to the board discussion part.
I'm assuming since we had the board approved, we had the last say. Is that how it's going to work?
If you can give me the last say in 3 minutes.
This would be the first city I've ever been to where the Planning Commission doesn't deal with conditional uses, and your ordinances say differently in any event. The chicken example, I suspect, and again, this is one of those issues that we haven't really had an opportunity to address or be prepared for. The chicken example, I suspect, is one where they've said they've had, by statute, they've set what the conditions are. So the city has already set what the conditions are for having these animals. And so all it is for an administrative point of view is he looks to see if those conditions have been met, which is a permitted use because they've set the conditions. It's not something that somebody's going to be able to look at and say, intensity and density, we need to have some different kinds of conditions apply in order to protect the neighborhood from any adverse consequences. If you look at sections, the other point I'd like to make is what the question there in terms of if you're looking at 2000, what was the statute and what was the procedure in 2000? And what was approved in 2000? What we do know is that it was only a clubhouse. And in 2000, the city wasn't even considering this building. And so what was approved in 2000, even there were some conditions, is not what's before the building official at this point. But if you look at section 10-6-3, the approval process, A, the procedure to be followed in securing approval of a planned town site project shall be as set forth under section 10-6-3 of this chapter. Well, if you go to 10-6-3 of the chapter, it says Planning Commission reviews and takes action on preliminary plans, documents, and statements. The Planning Commission shall review the preliminary plans, documents, and statements and shall recommend or not recommend or subject to modifications. The Planning Commission has some role in these large-scale developments. And that's where that subsection that I talked about. You know, the Planning Commission and people are working together on that development within the town site residential project. But you still come over on a conditional use. Well, what are those conditions? That's where the Planning Commission comes in and is able to set conditions for intensity and density and those kinds of things. I've been looking. I haven't been able to find it. I'm pretty confident I can find it given the amount of time. This Utah State Code talks about Planning Commission and their roles and conditional approvals and those kinds of things. And that's what the Planning Commission is for. This is the first city I've ever seen where anybody to stand and say Planning Commission or somebody, maybe the Board of Adjustment, doesn't have the right to establish conditional uses on some applications. And that's what this was intended. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. Did the Planning Commission review, address, discuss this particular development, this building, prior to the issuing of the council deciding they were going to build it, approving the plan and so on, and the building permit being issued?
I don't want to speak to the planning commission, but...
were you given information from them?
Yes, and I would add that we've done lots of conditional use facilities in the past, in fact, our whole commercial zone, and what that means is it goes to the planning commission for review, and it comes to the city council for review, and the planning commission and the city council can impose conditions or restrictions, like, you know, we want more landscaping, or... no, you need to move the traffic access here, those kinds of things. And the proposal did go to the planning commission and the city council. So that's exactly...
So that process was followed.
Yeah.
Were there any conditions put on the construction?
It was a little different in that this was a city-proposed project, and so it's kind of almost an argument between the developer and the city, where the developer wants to do the minimum they have to, and the city wants to make them do more. And in this case, the city council, in reviewing the plans many, many times, and then again with the planning commission, it was, you know, those conditions were part of the process of building the plans and revising the plans until it got to the point where, you know, it was finally approved.
Thank you. I would like to inquire as to whether or not any of the four individuals who signed the applicant as adjoining neighbors is present. Oh, well, whose names are listed? Are any of those people present? That would be Darren Adams and Crystal Budge, Bryce Nelson, or Jim Roberry. Okay. I would have allowed them an opportunity if they wish to speak to the particular ordinance or zone, but that was fine. I just wanted to allow that since their names were on there. Okay. Anyone have questions of anyone else?
Priscilla, Mr. Derringer, your name's on this paper. Do you have any comments? I hope so.
He definitely did.
I think the issues have been covered. The only reason I'm here is because, as a concerned citizen in this city, I would like things to be open and above board. I attended a lot of city council meetings. I've never seen a report. I don't know of a public hearing on this building by the Planning Commission. I think it needed to be studied by them and open, and I believe it should be brought to the vote of the people of this city. But that isn't what we're considering here. I still have seen nothing that would allow this to be in this zone without full process of going through planning commission and public hearings and all of that thing from the planning commission and getting their specific recommendations. I haven't seen anything submitted here tonight in writing from them that showed what their idea was, and I thought it was highly unusual to have a city council member. I don't know something, but I'm not aware of it. And I do trust you folks and your ability to make a decision as to what our city ordinances require, and appreciate the time you're going to take. And it's not an easy thing to do. And you take a lot of time and effort, and you're here because of your desire to serve the city. And I thank you for it.
Thank you. Kim, is there a written record of the minutes of the council meeting where they approved this particular project and made reference to input from the Planning Commission relating to this project? Does that exist?
There are minutes, but I don't have them with me, of course.
But there are
minutes when the council approved the facility.
But those minutes would also, do you believe that they would represent you?
They would have the history.
Okay. Gentlemen, comments, questions, anyone else you want to ask? Anything else?
But my concern here is that there seems to be some ambiguity in my mind anyway as to how the process is working in the city. And unfortunately, I didn't have the kind of time I would have liked to have reviewed this in advance where I could have determined that. I would personally appreciate if we could maybe put the decision in advance for a short period of time until I could satisfy a few things in my own mind.
It's a lot to digest in a day. I mean, we're talking legal matters here. We're talking definitions. We're talking 11 years worth of history. And it's very hard to get a grasp on this thing and just what we're hearing, because there are conflicting sides. And we can read what we've got in the book, and I have. And like I say, it's still kind of ambiguous. We're dragging on something here for 11 years, and we're trying to, I mean, things are changing during that time period, but we're not allowing for that change somehow. And you're right. Has the Planning Commission looked at this other than just maybe they did review it? And it'd be nice to know if they did consider what the ramifications, the impacts, and everything.
Do you believe that extended time will change the fact that there's still going to be two separate sides to this?
Well, basically, if I read the information right, it says the only thing we're here to consider is whether the permit was issued legally or illegally.
Yes.
I mean, there's a thousand other issues going on here.
Right.
Yeah.
Which we really
and it's very hard to boil them all down to that permit.
Yeah.
See, so if there's anything else that can be brought to light through other minutes, through other hearings, I think it would help a little bit in making a decision as to whether this thing is authorized or unauthorized.
Jeff, Buck?
I'm okay tonight. I don't know if sleeping on this is going to change a lot of what's been presented to me. I think I got kind of an idea where what makes sense to me. And, when you ever get two lawyers, you're not going to have ambiguity. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. And I do think that a lot's been given to us today. But I did take the time the last couple of days, and I spent a lot of time reviewing most of this. I've read it all three or four times. And I feel like I've got a grasp on it. I can move ahead tonight.
Okay. All right. Well, I need a motion from one of you as to whether or not you wish to proceed with a vote or you wish to proceed for a delay. I need to know.
I'll make the motion that we delay this for a period of at least 1 week.
Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
We'll vote. All those in favor of the delay?
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nay.
Nay. So the motion doesn't carry. Yes, ma'am?
May I just say something? We have two members of the Planning Commission here. Would it be helpful if they could get up and talk to you about what information they came to have through their meeting?
Who was an individual member
Mr.
of the Planning Commission?
The Chairman of the Planning Commission.
Okay, sir, in 3 minutes or less, can you address directly whether or not you as members of the Planning Commission addressed the issue of building this particular building structure at this time just prior to when the building permit would have been issued?
The answer to that question is no. It never came before the Planning Commission.
Okay.
We discussed it.
What does that mean?
We discussed it during our discussion period at the end of our meeting, but we were never presented with any kind of maps, drawings, elevations, anything that we could take any action on.
Okay. Did you discuss it during the term of the meeting before the meeting was adjourned?
Yes.
And how did it come up as one of the items that would be discussed?
Because it was a matter that had come before the City Council, or we knew it was coming before the City Council. And one of the questions I had at the time was, shouldn't this come before the Planning Commission to make our recommendations to the City Council? One thing that you should understand, we do not make any final decisions. We're a recommending body only. So any discussion that we have on any matter, when it comes before us, we make recommendations to the City Council, and it's the City Council's decision to either accept those recommendations, throw the recommendations out, accept some of them, none of them, whatever. But at no time were we officially given this project to review and to make comment to the City Council on.
Did you or any member of the Planning Commission send any message or comment, even though it was ex officio?
Not that I'm aware of. I did not.
Anyone else have a... One second. Anyone else? You have a question?
No. So what you're telling us that you never applied, gave any kind of counsel on this particular project to the City Council?
That's correct.
Was there any discussion of a clubhouse slash recreation center slash public youth building, whatever, in the Planning Commission prior at any time, say in the last 2 years? Did you ever, as a Planning Commission, discuss that, and did you give recommendations to the Council pertaining to that?
We discussed the fact that we knew what was going on, and because that was the hot topic, if you will, at the time, and all of us on the Planning Commission, we had varying opinions as to what, you know, we would like to see or what we thought should be seen, so forth. But as far as any official act, nothing, we gave nothing at all to the City Council as far as being official with the Planning Commission.
Thank you.
Just one thing. In your opinion as chairman of the Planning Commission, did you feel like you legally needed to see it, or you just liked to have saw it?
I questioned why it wasn't coming before the Planning Commission, and I was told by the assistant city manager that it didn't need to.
Okay. In light of that, I think we've been somewhat misrepresented.
Thank you.
We've had information misrepresented to us because it sounds like that part of the process never occurred.
If that process is required.
And I don't know that it's required in the city's ordinances per se. That's Mr. Carlisle's contention. But Mr. Crowe,
that's what Kim was just addressing.
If you could formally address.
Yes. So the confusion here is,
when
we get feedback from the Planning Commission, it doesn't come in the form of like a written report or something like that. We have an ex officio member on the Planning Commission, and they can relay information, and or one of the city staff, when they reviewed the project, they said, well, the Planning Commission brought out these points. And so while, you know, like I said, I don't want to speak from the Planning Commission. I don't attend Planning Commission meetings. I'm not the Planning Commission representative from the City Council. So, you know, members of the Planning Commission, we discussed it, that kind of thing, but apparently it never officially went before the Planning Commission. I just want to clarify that, you know, there's feedback given, but as far as, you know, I don't know what forum. I'd have to defer to Cliff on how they discussed it, but we never get, like, a written report. We just get information passed on usually through city staff.
Priscilla, do you want me to address
for me what the city ordinance is in relationship to issuing permits for conditional uses.
Okay, let me just give you some background. I have been with the city for 20 years. And for, how long has Greg Robinson been here? 4 years. Greg Robinson has been here for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And he took over the planning at that time. Prior to that, I was the assistant planner for the city, working with Rodney Lestain. So I worked with all of this information. That's why I can hopefully explain it and clear some of the issues. The Planning Commission's responsibility is that they were to approve the town site residential development, the plat, ABC, whatever. That was the Planning Commission's purpose, okay? When the houses were built, and including when this building is built, the building permit is submitted, which Brad Curl addresses. What he has to address is that the building meets setbacks, height restrictions, all kinds of information that he has to make sure those buildings meet that criteria. And that's Brad's job. And it's the same with this job. This building does not go before the Planning Commission. It's Brad's job to approve this building. Now, the Planning Commission does have the responsibility in the commercial zone because everything in our commercial zone is conditional. And so the application that someone makes if they want to build in the commercial zone is simply their application of, this is what I want to build, here's the elevations, here's the site plan, all of that information, that goes to the Planning Commission. And the Planning Commission acts on that permit. The permit does not have the name conditional use permit, even though everything in the commercial is conditional. That is what the Planning Commission addresses. So there seems to be this confusion with the Planning Commission addresses the land use development, which they did and approved way back in 2000. Once the buildings start coming in, and this site was approved for a building, now there was a cart tent, there was a trailer, there was a huge sunset room, and now, in my opinion, the city has decided to bring that facility all together in one. And as long as Brad finds that it meets the zoning, the setbacks, the height restrictions, all of those things, it went through the council, who is the land use authority. They gave their approval on the building, and then Brad is allowed to take that building permit and issue the permit if it meets the zoning regulations as far as setbacks and the building itself, not the land around it, the building itself.
Were any of those previous structures, the sunset room, the whatever, did they require building permits?
You'd have to ask Brad if they had to have a building permit.
That's a good question. I wasn't the building official at the time, I don't believe, but I'll have to look into that. I'm sure that we did do some inspections and such, but those were also special constructed prefab buildings that the manufacturers come out, and they have their own specific special inspectors and engineers that come out, and they watch and monitor how they're, like that quantum up where the cart barn is and such. It's a very specialized building, so they come out and address that. But yes, those facilities, we had a portable, you know, those modular units that were acting as the clubhouse, things like that. And we went out and inspected how the sewer was connected, how the plumbing's connected, electrical, and so on and so forth.
Well, my question is, if a permit was issued for buildings on that site, and this is, could this be conceived as an extension of those by taking all of them and, as she's implying, putting it all into one, into this facility, then if there was a building permit issued then the building permit theoretically could continue as being issued for this as well. That's why I was curious if there were permits issued for those structures.
Yes, certainly there are permits issued for every structure in the city, but obviously those facilities were not extending or adding on to a trailer.
Right.
You know, we
right.
eliminated those,
right.
started fresh, and yes, combining all those uses into one facility.
But I would not believe that if there was a permit issued for one building, that because you're combining multiple buildings and building a new building, you don't get a transfer.
But what I'm looking at is if it didn't go to the Planning Commission to issue a permit for the clubhouse that looked like X, then did it need to go to the Planning Commission directly to issue a permit for a clubhouse that now looks like Y? Okay.
Priscilla, this goes back. I was on a planning commission a lot of years ago, and as I remember it, the things that we addressed, we had two functions. One was just like he mentioned, subdivision-type things. There were two or three things that by code we had to review first. They could not go to the city council before they went to the planning commission. They had to go through the door, and we had the ability to kill it before the city ever saw it if we didn't like it. But there was a myriad of other things. They used us as a sounding board. We didn't have any legal authority. They might ask our opinion to review this and give us an opinion on it. But the only things that I remember that were legally binding were subdivisions or just two or three of them that we were required to do.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. That would be the development part.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Kim, which things are legally binding for the Planning Commission?
The Planning Commission legally has to address a subdivision, a lease subdivision, a vacation of the plat. And they also have to address the conditional uses in our commercial zone.
Yes, sir? Do not be lengthy.
Okay. I will.
Thank you.
Look at section 10-6D-2, permitted uses.
I think I put that down.
Since the following building structures and uses of land may be permitted within the planned town site project, any use permitted with the underlying zone of those that are authorized under this section, then it goes in to enumerate them. Common areas and recreational facilities, public and private, including but not limited to golf courses, swimming pools, tennis courts, clubhouses, recreational buildings, landscape, pond areas and features, and other similar recreational facilities for the use and enjoyment of the residents. It goes on through some common utility systems, and it goes on through some public parks and recreation. But those are the uses that may be in these town site recreation projects. And that's what's being considered. It's not just the use of the land, it's the buildings. Then you say 10-6D-3A. The procedure to be followed is securing approval of a planned town site project, which includes buildings, shall be as set forth under section 10-6-3 of this chapter. So you go to 10-6-3 of the chapter. Planning Commission reviews and takes action on preliminary plans, documents, and statements. One, the Planning Commission shall review the preliminary plans, documents, and statements together with, and that's a shall, by the way, together with the findings of the staff review process and shall act to recommend or not recommend a proposal or recommend it subject to modification. That's uses and buildings. And the Planning Commission has that responsibility, and it's a mandatory statement.
Thank you.
Just in regards to what you just said, if you could just say.
Well,
tell me what page you're on.
Yeah. He's on, I think he's reading from the Article D10 Town Site Project, and he went through the permitted uses. Permitted uses is just saying that these are the items that are allowed in the town site project. Okay?
Yes.
The approval process has to do with the approval of a town site project. Not the buildings within it, it's the project. It's the land, it's the number of lots, it's the size of the lot. All of those types of things is what the Planning Commission addresses. It has to do with the development of the land, not what is built on the land. It's the development of the land.
I think it says that. It says the procedure to be followed in securing approval of a planned town site
project
shall be as set forth.
Not the building, it's
it
the
does
project.
Specifically say that. Alright.
So are you saying then that any change to that, to the plan, can just be made without regard to the original approval?
If any change made to the project. So if somebody had one of those lots and they wanted to subdivide it,
okay.
The lot process has to go through the Planning Commission.
Right.
Not putting something on it. That has to do with Brad, who does the setbacks, the heights, and those kind of things.
If you look at some of these things that were mentioned, for example, it talks about private driveways, fences, walls, all of those things don't have to go to the Planning Commission
in order to do that.
So as a result, I think that if you read all of those things under permitted uses, it says these are the things that you can be permitted to do in the zone, and none of those things have to go to the Planning Commission. They don't have to decide about everybody putting up a fence.
Or even the plans for the houses themselves. Individually, they don't even come to the City Council, right?
Thank you.
What is the... 10-6D-2, at the end of the second paragraph, who is defined as resident? Is it residents of the particular zone that's being considered? Or is that
the plan residential
general?
Area? Yes. Is that what you want to know? Or
yes.
The whole team owns it?
Well, no, in this particular case, it talks for the,
why don't you read
the
that?
Residents. Is that residents of the specific?
Would you read what you're talking about there, so I don't have to look it up?
All right. It's under permitted uses, and it states it lists the list of
10-6D-2
under permitted uses, and it talks about that common areas, recreational facilities, public and private, including but not limited to golf courses, swimming pools, tennis courts, clubhouses, recreational buildings, landscape, pond areas, and features, and similar recreational facilities for the use and enjoyment of the residents.
Oh, okay, I got you.
So is that residents as a whole? Of what?
Yeah, how is that defined?
Well, it's not. So it's open to interpretation, I guess.
Well, but then that brings us back to Mr. Collins' point about whether there's ambiguity, and I think that that in and of itself provides ambiguity, because we don't know who those residents are that it's referring to.
It almost could be construed to mean that it's just the residents of that
particular
zone.
Or we
could
address that as well. No, I think I can probably guess how each of you would address that. So, thank you. I think we need to, as a board, we need to decide. We need to vote. The motion did not pass to postpone, so we will need to make a decision. And I will give you adequate time to explain if you wish, or not explain if you choose not to, your particular vote. And we'll start with you.
Okay. You know, I've tried to understand everything that's been said here tonight, and obviously we've got some disagreement between the two legal sides, and we have some confusion, some ambiguity in the ordinances themselves. And it sounds like there are precedents that have been established through long use in the community that, whether they're right or wrong, that's the way that things have been done. But I think that the way I'm reading these ordinances, I think that there is enough ambiguity in my mind that I'm inclined to support the applicant.
Okay, thank you.
I have the first part of that with you in that I believe there's some ambiguity. A strict interpretation of the one code, you didn't see that as a permitted use. But if you follow it down into a train, you end up in another part where it is permitted. That ambiguity, to me, throws me back to legislative intent. What the legislative intent, the precursor, the preamble, like you said, and it's very obvious in the preamble that it is a permitted use. I mean, the fact that it wasn't there, to me, is once this becomes very confusing, I go back to what did they really intend for this area? And to me, it's very clear that they intended to have a golf course, a clubhouse. Those things were, you know, when they designed it, that was a legitimate use of the thing. So that's where I end up.
Thank you. Mr. Olford.
For the record, what position?
I would vote to reject the application.
I'm having a hard time in my mind separating this Plat C, which we're all talking about, from the whole city of Cedar Hills.
Plat B.
Or whichever it is. Yeah, B, including the D, C, what have you. Because clearly, everything was approved for that area on that 240-acre minimum site, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a clubhouse that was approved at that point in time. The question is, can we transport that approval 11 years down the road from a clubhouse for a homeowners association to a recreational facility for the entire city of 10,000? And that's very confusing because there is no clear trail here.
Because I'm not certain it was a clubhouse for the homeowners association. It may have been a clubhouse for the golf
course, which is a city. At least my impression was is that.
I've only been here for five years, so I kind of
blew
in your mind. You guys have the history, and I'm looking at it from an outside.
At the point of the approval, it was a private facility.
That's why I say it was a private development,
and that may be true.
With a clubhouse.
It was.
And I'm familiar with homeowners associations, and I've had clubhouses, but you couldn't get in there unless you belonged to that homeowners association.
Yeah, this was a clubhouse.
I've had the
related
cars.
To the golf course. It was not related to the homeowners association.
Okay, so that clubhouse in those days was intended for the golf course.
Yes.
Which was a
I believe
facility.
So.
That's true.
Having been here,
yeah,
as many years as I have been here, I
See, I guess that's just to clarify, the developer built the original project, including the golf course and the surrounding homes. It was all one project. The city, the voters of Cedar Hills later voted, and the city council also voted to exercise their right to purchase the golf course from the developer.
So then we purchased that as a mm-hmm. city asset as opposed to a homeowner's asset.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So then that's that act then, in essence, since we don't need a planning commission, all reverts back to the city council. Is that true?
It would seem so.
I would assume so.
And if the city council approves the project, then legally what the city engineer did is just authorize that permit based on the approval of the city council for a project that... And that's why I say, and with everything that's flying around here, the issue is the permit, legal or not legal. And that's a hard one.
I have a question on this.
I'm sorry.
Of order.
I think we need to let him finish his thought and his voting and how he's going to vote. I believe that just while we are definitely going to need to address and are charged with addressing the legality of the issue of the permit, I did want to make one comment about due process. My personal opinion was when the appellant filed the action and indicated that they wished to address this issue, that should have been the starting gun, if you would, to preparation for whenever the board was going to meet. And I think that Mr. Carlisle has provided an extremely adequate defense of the appellant, and I think that essentially he has demonstrated simply through that it must have been adequate time because he provided an excellent amount of information. As for the matter at hand, I believe that there is, as Mr. Carlisle mentioned, he said that there was no ambiguity in the TR1 zone, but I believe that there is ambiguity, and we have just discussed that. And as a result, I think that that ambiguity had to be clarified and has been clarified through following the progression from the TR1 zone to the conditional use to the permitted uses under the planned residential development. I believe that the methodology used by the town in prior history, which apparently has not been challenged prior to this point, has supported the process that this went through. This was not different. It did not deviate. It was repetitive of processes that have happened before in issuing permits. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to vote against the appellant because I believe that the permit was issued legally. Mr. Walker?
Well, that's what I say with everything that's been done. Clearly, there needs to be better procedures. But we don't have time to do that. It's not our,
not for us,
not our authority to do that anyway. It pains me, but I think I'll have to go along and say that the permit was issued based on what we've talked about. But it's a cloudy issue, but So I don't think we can do anything about it at this point.
All right. The vote is 3 votes against the appellant and his request to deny the permit.
Can I make a motion?
And, oh, I'm sorry. I do need a motion for that.
Okay. I know it's to kill you. I'd move that we deny the request for killing the building permit.
A second. Do you have a second?
I'll second.
Okay. The motion carries 3-1.
Maybe I have to ask for a vote.
Okay. We will vote one more time, Mr. Cheney. The motion is, should we deny...
No, the motion is to deny
to the deny request. The request to kill the building permit.
And I vote no.
I vote yes.
Yes.
All right. And so the motion carries. I think it should be noted for the record that we are not a satisfied group necessarily by the procedures the town has in place, but we are bound by what does exist and the law as we have seen it, and we believe that we've acted fairly in that respect. Thank you all for your attention.
Now you have to adjourn.
A motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn the meeting.
I'll take it now.
And we are adjourned.
Second
day. And the vote? I vote yes.
You adjourned.
We're adjourning.
I mean, he was very reticent.
I know.
Well, I wondered about that.